Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In the wake of President Trump's pronouncements about Iran last week at the UN General Assembly, we'll hear from the lead negotiator of the Iranian nuclear deal, an agreement from which the U.S. has withdrawn, yet an agreement to which the other signatories, the permanent UN Security Council members plus Germany and the European Union, remain committed. Ambassador Wendy Sherman is the former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in the Obama administration. She's currently a senior counselor at the Albright Stonebridge Group and a senior fellow at Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. Ambassador Sherman led the U.S. negotiating team that reached agreement on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the formal name for the Iran nuclear deal. She previously served as a counselor to Secretary of State Madeleine Albright in the Clinton administration and was a special advisor to the president in the government's negotiations with North Korea. She's now written a memoir of her life and her negotiations with the Iranians titled Not for the Faint of Heart, Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persistence. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week, and I spoke with her while she was here. Ambassador Sherman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's terrific to be here with you, Rich. Thank you.
Congratulations on the new book, too, Not for the Faint of Heart. We'll talk about the book, but I would like to begin by looking at where the agreement that you helped negotiate is today. The U.S. has withdrawn from the Iran nuclear deal and is preparing even more sanctions at this moment. Many countries, though, are defying the U.S.'s call to halt trade with Iran. So where does the agreement stand today?
The agreement stands, nobody's sure. Indeed, because of U.S. sanctions being reimposed by President Trump, a lot of the big companies like Siemens, Allianz, Total, Peugeot have all left Iran because the sanctions that are coming in November say that if you do any business with the Central Bank of Iran, you can't do any business with an American bank. And all of these large companies care much more about American banks than they do about the Central Bank of Iran. What the Europeans are trying to do, along with Russia and China, is create a special purpose vehicle that would get around some of those sanctions so that small and medium business can invest, so people can purchase oil. Whether that special purpose vehicle will work or not remains to be seen. But I think it's important for listeners to know this wasn't just a deal between the United States and Iran. This deal was made by all of the permanent members of the Security Council. So that's Great Britain, France, the United States, Russia, China, plus Germany, coordinated and supported by the European Union, and then got a 15-0 vote on the Security Council. So this is an international agreement. It's not just a U.S. agreement. That doesn't mean that President Trump is in his rights to take whatever action he deems appropriate. I don't happen to agree with what he's done. But it has consequences not just for the deal, which concerns me greatly because it's about our national security and whether Iran will be able to get a nuclear weapon. Right now, it can't because of the deal. But it also concerns me because it's another step to breaking our alliance with Europe, which is quite crucial to us economically.
So by all accounts, is Iran living up to, you know, the ink of the deal?
Indeed. I think before the president withdrew, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is the group that monitors what's happening with the deal, issued 11 reports that they were in full compliance. I think there's been at least one since the president's gone out. So, yes, they have been complying with the deal in total.
And I think in your book you allude to one of the first attempts to negotiate with Iran when they had so many centrifuges. By the time you're negotiating with them, it's like thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands.
Yes. What happens is that people think that sanctions make people change their behavior. But when the Europeans began negotiating with Iran, because they began before we did, quite in the early 2000s, Iran had 164 centrifuges. Centrifuges are a part of what you need to make a nuclear weapon, to make highly enriched uranium, which is the fissionable material for a nuclear bomb. By the time we got to 2013, into those 2 years of incredibly serious negotiations, they had 19,000.
That's what it
was. So sanctions get someone to the negotiating table, but they didn't stop Iran from building a nuclear program.
Yeah. So explain how the EU's idea, this idea of special purpose vehicles, where they'll trade in euros, which sort of avoids involving U.S. banking.
Trade in euros and trade in barter facilities to try to not have currency. The problem is oil is traded in dollars, and the reserve currency of the world is dollars. And in fact, one of the things that Secretary of the Treasury Jack Lew, who served under President Obama, used to say to us is be really careful in using these what are called secondary economic sanctions, because if we use them too often, the rest of the world is going to say, well, let's have a basket of currencies. Let's not just rely on the dollar. And that would be terrible for us.
Why would that be terrible for us?
Because we would no longer then be as in charge as we are of the global economy and how it proceeds forward.
Because dollars are the predominant currency, we're sort of immune to a lot of speculation and currency fluctuations that some other countries are?
Absolutely, as a result of us being the reserve currency, yes.
Mm. Now, already some countries have said we're going to still buy oil from Iran. I think India is the last one I saw that said we're going to buy oil from Iran. What does this do for American leadership?
Well, American leadership is quite challenged at the moment. A few days ago, the president was at the UN General Assembly, the high-level meetings of the UN General Assembly, what we call diplomatic speed dating, because during that week, since everybody's in the same place, you usually start at 7 in the morning and go to midnight, meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, because it's such a great opportunity. And the president said he's not for multilateralism. He's not for globalization of any sort. He said he was for quote-unquote patriotism, but what he really means is we're going to do just what we want to do, and everybody should do what they want to do. But so many problems, whether it is terrorism or cyber or pandemics, climate, drugs, all cross borders, they don't really care about borders. And so if you want to tackle any of these really tough problems, the economy as well, which is global, even if we like to think it's local, we're in a lot of trouble if we don't understand we need to work and play well with others, maintaining our own interests and our own national concerns, of course.
Traditionally, even when maybe politically, like an issue like climate change, depending on the administration, is a somewhat contentious issue, doesn't traditionally the United States sort of lead the discussions for the most part?
Absolutely. Some of our power comes from the fact that most of the world has said since World War II, we'll do our part, but we're followers, and nothing happens without American leadership. And that's being challenged right now.
Yeah. You relate in your book, you said, you know, the very first framework for the agreement was in secret. You added all the rest of the parties that became a part of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is the Iran nuclear deal, later. But the first was basically the United States meeting in secret with Iranian diplomatic members.
Yes. President Obama decided after an initial testing of that relationship under the auspices of the Sultan of Oman, whom John Kerry, who at that point was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and told then Secretary Hillary Clinton and President Obama he thought that the Sultan might help create a relationship. This was before the current president of Iran, who's considered moderate in their terms, not in our terms. He's a hardliner.
Ahmadinejad was
still president. So President Obama sent a couple of terrific guys to meet. There seemed to be some traction. And then he asked Ambassador Bill Burns, who's really the diplomat's diplomat, to lead a small team to see if there was any traction. And quite frankly, as the new Iranian election approached, things looked like they weren't going anywhere. And then when Rouhani was elected, there was a big change in circumstance. Some rethinking of our strategy on our side, and things began to move.
Well, let's talk about how things are in Iran now. Rouhani is still president, but I can't imagine that the United States' decision to withdraw from this agreement has helped him in any way. It's probably hurt him, and it's probably solidified I think you referred in the book as there are hardliners, and then there are hardliners.
Indeed. You did read the book, yes. It has solidified the hardliners. They are trying to get back in control of the economy. President Rouhani has been challenged. The value of the rial, their currency, has plummeted. People are having a hard time. But when I was in New York a few days ago for the General Assembly, I joined a small group meeting with President Rouhani. I'd never met him before, and I wanted to get a sense of him. I know the foreign minister quite well, and several other Iranians quite well after spending 4 years negotiating with them. But he was very sober. He said, you know, we've gotten through tough times before. There was 12 years of the Iran-Iraq war. They got through that. He believes they will get through this. He doesn't like being, in his words, treated in this fashion because this was an international agreement. Whether this is sustainable, I think, remains to be seen. But he was quite calm and collected in that conversation.
Given that this is likely to go on for at least several more years with the U.S. not participating in this and probably actively seeking sanctions, is it prudent to think that the Iranian regime won't resume its nuclear testing facility and trying to build their nuclear capability?
Well, they're trying to hang on right now to the agreement because they know that if they spend all the money they have on building nuclear weapons, then it doesn't necessarily improve the plight of the everyday Iranian. And half of the Iranian population's under the age of 30 or 35, but quite young. You know, Iran is not doing good things in the world. Iran does behave really badly in the Middle East and does need to be challenged in that regard. But all of the sanctions that we had on Iran for that behavior remained after we got the nuclear deal. And there were tools that we had at hand to try to attack that. In fact, because we had a channel of communication, we had begun to talk with them about some of these other issues, which are of legitimate concern to all of us. So it's a matter not that we, those of us who negotiate this agreement, believe that Iran's a wonderful country and everything's hunky-dory. They're doing a lot of really bad things, but we thought there was better tools and a better approach to try to tackle those issues.
Trump administration plan for Iran is seeming to be putting sanctions back into place, and that will force Iran to renegotiate a lot of these larger issues well beyond their ability to acquire nuclear weapons or nuclear energy. And the idea of sort of supplanting their support for Hezbollah, support for Shia groups that are in conflicts throughout the Middle East, isn't that apples and oranges?
I think it would be a really tough negotiation for two reasons. First, if we want more, we have to be willing to put more on the table. And what is that more? We have a primary embargo against Iran. Are we ready to lift that primary embargo? Are we ready to do other things?
Give them aid.
Give them aid and assistance. So usually if you want more, you have to do more. Secondly, the reason we didn't do everything all at once is then you're negotiating against yourself. So Iran might have said, okay, I'll tell Hezbollah not to fire so many rockets, but I want more advanced centrifuges now as opposed to so many years from now. And we believed that the greatest threat was Iran having a nuclear weapon, because as bad as what they're doing in the Middle East is now, if they had a nuclear weapon, they could project enormous power and deter even further our ability to stop them.
Right now, you said they're trying to live up to the substance of the agreement, but I can't imagine that they're not looking at the example of what U.S. is now doing with North Korea, and the example of North Korea where a regime does have nuclear weapons, and all of a sudden the administration is trying to relate to the Kim regime in a way it's never tried to relate to it before. Doesn't that strengthen the hand of those who say Iran should pursue nuclear weapons?
There are certainly a large contingent of people, particularly in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, who believe that they should go the route of North Korea and actually have nuclear weapons. They'd have more chips on the table and more to bargain with. You know, on North Korea, which I've had the, I never know what the right word is.
That was your first rodeo.
Right. Experience negotiating with North Koreans, which is quite tough. And a deal with North Korea is much, much more difficult than a deal with Iran because, obviously, as you said, they have nuclear weapons and they have the missile system that could deliver those nuclear weapons to the United States. So I think it's a very tough go. I'm glad that the president had a summit because both he and Kim Jong-un believe they're the only ones who matter in the world. And even though we do have a democracy with checks and balances, that's not how the president sees it. So I thought, well, maybe this will get a breakthrough. But to get a breakthrough, you have to have a plan, you have to have a team, you have to have discipline, you have to really be ready to go at it. Before we ever started negotiating the large nuclear deal, my team wrote an entire agreement. It was hundreds of pages long. We all combed through it line by line. And the ultimate deal, which of course didn't look exactly like what we'd written, was 110 pages long. So These are very complex and difficult and technical negotiations.
My guest today is Ambassador Wendy Sherman. She is a diplomat and former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, the lead negotiator for the Iran nuclear deal, and is the author of a memoir about that experience and her life and all of her experiences, Not for the Faint of Heart, Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persistence. It's published by Public Affairs, and she was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week. I would like to talk a little bit about your book. There's really some interesting sort of sidebars into the niceties and the small things that go into creating a successful negotiation. Right off the bat, as a female lead negotiator, you had a problem because the Iranian delegation are not going to shake your hand as a woman.
Indeed.
And, we know the handshake is a symbolic gesture. How important is it in diplomacy?
I think all of those things are a way of trying to find common ground. Even a simple handshake is something different cultures still may do with each other. So that's in itself a point of common ground. So if you're a woman dealing with a culture that cannot shake your hand, you're sort of a little outside, and we figured out a way, we women, to deal with that. We put our hand across our chest and we sort of nod our head. But if you're in a room full of men, you sort of looks like a Marx Brothers routine after a little while. So one day in trying to find that common ground, since we could shake hands, my counterparts were Abbas Araghchi and Majid Ravanchi, who were deputy foreign ministers, and they were the day negotiators in the way that I was. And I started to talk with them just sort of when we were standing around at one point, and told them that I'd grown up in a largely Jewish community, and many of the folks in that community were Orthodox Jews, and those men couldn't shake my hand either. And we talked about that a little bit. It was awkward at first, and particularly for a country that believes Israel should be wiped off the face of the earth and denies the Holocaust. It was sort of bizarre. But nonetheless, they found it fascinating, and it provided a way for us to sort of get past a very awkward situation.
And there's lots of incidences of this, of trying to find human common ground. Mm-hmm. How important is that in a negotiation?
It's incredibly important. A whole chapter in the book on finding common ground, which I think we try to do in relationships that we have, in organizations and businesses and universities in which we work. And it's critical in negotiations because otherwise you're talking past each other. You never can find what that common objective is and find a pathway to it.
Now, in the case of the Iranian leadership that you were negotiating with, many of these men had been educated in the West, very fluent in English. Even though they were men of Iran, they also had a foot in the Western world. I have to ask you about negotiating with North Koreans. How do you find common grounds with North Koreans where, for the most part, many of them have been completely isolated and in a culture of one man as a leader?
North Korea is more of a cult in some ways than a country because it is dynastic and it is about one individual who, you know, is seen as the dear leader or the great leader or the leader.
And there's a deistic sort of
very effect. Very much so, very yeah. much so, Rich. And when one goes to North Korea, you have no control over your schedule. Secretary Pompeo found that out when he went to North Korea thinking he was going to meet with as he's called, Chairman Kim, because he's chairman of their defense committee, and he didn't get the meeting because you don't get to call the shots in any way. The sort of diplomatic niceties or the diplomatic patter doesn't necessarily exist. And when I was privileged to go on the historic trip with Secretary Madeleine Albright to Pyongyang in 2000, we were in a meeting. He said, I'm going to take you to someplace special. We got in cars, found ourselves entering a stadium with thousands and thousands of people chanting the dear leader's name for 10 minutes. And, you know, we were there figuring out what we were supposed to do. You can't be undiplomatic. And at the same time, you know, you sort of have to sit there with frozen smiles on your face. I think even in those situations, you try to find common ground. We were often, Secretary Albright would sit on one side of Kim and I on the other. And we were watching another performance on another evening. And I said to him, I feel like you in some ways may have been a director in another lifetime, because he's very proud of these big events he puts on. And he said, yes, he had every Academy Award film that he watched. We had found out from my counterpart at a previous meeting that he had every NBA basketball tape of Michael Jordan. So we had brought him a basketball signed by Michael Jordan. So you find some place to connect.
What was also interesting about this book was there's a story of women empowerment and how you've worked within the State Department and as a congressional aide and trying to sort of find a women's club to equal the old boys club in Washington. And it was really interesting some of the ways in which you do this. You talk about even in the Obama White House where there were a number of top level women aides where you'd be in the Situation Room. Susan Rice, National Security Advisor, would make a point and around the room it goes and somebody makes the exact same point without referencing the National Security Advisor. And you came up with an interesting scheme to sort of empower the women of the Situation Room, if you will.
We sort of got an unspoken rule. It was at a time when Susan was the National Security Advisor and two of her deputies were women, Avril Haines and Lisa Monaco, really talented, extraordinary women. And we sort of had this unwritten rule that if one of us said something that was said by a guy 10 minutes later, to which everyone applauded the guy, one of us would say, and I'm sure many of the women listeners know this routine, one of us would say, "Mark, that was really great that you picked up on Susan's point." Just to sort of subtly say, you know, this isn't the first time this has landed on this table. I think it's incredibly important for women to create a support network wherever they work, just so you know you're not crazy. And particularly if you're a mom as well, and you're trying to juggle all the pieces of your life, and more dads are trying to do that as well. Having a support system and being able to get through the day is important. You know, one of the reasons that I wrote this book, combining both what I did in my professional life with what my life was, is that we are the sum total of all that we are. It's not just you have your work self and your home self, but you bring everything to everything you do. And if you do bring everything you are to what you do, it's when you are your most powerful.
Well, you tell some really remarkable stories. And the idea that today, and it shouldn't be a surprise, that I think you write, this has gotten some publicity about men will go for a job in Washington with about 50 to 60% of the job experience underneath their feet. Women won't do that unless they see the whole thing. This whole idea that it's really difficult to break boys' clubs, even in the highest powers of Washington,
yes.
Still.
Well, we've certainly seen that over the last few days as we've had this hearing about the Supreme Court, that we still have a ways to go to understand each other and the challenges that we each face in our lives. And I think that's true in our country amongst all of us. One of the reasons on my talking about the book to come to Tulsa is I don't want to just be in New York and Miami, Washington, and San Francisco. I want to come to the center of the country because I think we have to talk with each other and, more importantly, listen to each other. And I'm really looking forward to listening to citizens here in Tulsa about their concerns in the world.
Yeah. In the book, you mention a few people that have been important to you in helping you understand your own role in the world. One would be your first main mentor, Senator Barbara Mikulski, and Madeleine Albright, who you work with in the State Department. How do these women affect your own path through the State Department and your work experience?
Well, it's interesting. We've sort of gone in both directions because both Senator Mikulski and Secretary Albright are about a decade older than I am. And Secretary Albright and I actually, she went to Wellesley and she and I did a session at Wellesley last year about how we sort of influenced each other because when I first got to know her back in the 80s, she really probably wouldn't have called herself a feminist. She would today. But because of where she was generationally and having come from Europe, it just wasn't her mindset. And she also taught me that when you're a negotiator and you're sitting across that table, I'm not a woman, I'm not Wendy Sherman, I'm not, in my case, an American Jew. I'm the United States of America. And if you own that power, it's a pretty darn good set of tools to have. And Senator Mikulski, I ran her first successful campaign for the United States Senate, so I hope I helped her. But she taught me how important it is to be your authentic self. When she ran, she was 4 feet 11. She joked that togas didn't come in a size 14 petite. But she, when people said, how are you going to be a senator? Because she was outspoken and came from working class roots and just didn't look the part. She said, this is what a senator looks like. This is what a senator is. And she has always been her true self. And that's what got her elected. That's what's made her the most popular politician in Maryland, because people know that when she fights for them, that's who she is.
You repeat that quote in the book about when you're sitting down as a negotiator, you're no longer Wendy Sherman. You're no longer any, you're the United States of America. I have to ask about the reception the president received in his latest UN General Assembly speech, where it appeared that the assembled leaders of the world were laughing at the president of the United States. Now, they booed the president of the United States in past speeches. They've applauded. I don't think they've ever laughed at the president of the United States. What does this say? I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're the most fervent Trump supporter or the most fervent Trump opponent. What does this say about the United States that, you know, a president goes to the opening of the UN General Assembly and is laughed at, basically?
It was quite a moment, Rich. You know, no American, as you say, no matter what your political views are, thinks it's wonderful to have the president be laughed at by the world, but he was. And it was in part because he started his speech about bragging how he had done so much so fast. And the UN is a more staid institution. That's sort of not what they expected.
They don't expect a campaign speech.
They don't expect a campaign speech or a campaign rally. And I think it just struck the wrong note. And I think the laughter was partly discomfort, like, where am I and who is this and why are we here? And it's not good for America, and it isolates us further from the rest of the world.
When you look at everything that's happened over the last couple of years, I know you were part of the Obama administration, so you're a critic, but is it that isolation that most concerns you?
What most concerns me is absolutely that we isolate ourselves from the world. You know, when we had the 2008 recession, I thought we all came to understand that we aren't decoupled from anybody, that as we go, so goes the rest of the world. As the rest of the world goes, so go we. But I know that not just in the United States, but around the world, there is a sense that some people have been left out and left behind, that folks are afraid in some ways of how fast the world is changing. Women can work, gay people can get married, people can go to any bathroom. Manufacturing jobs aren't what they once were. Technology is taking over, let alone what artificial intelligence is going to do to the labor force. And so a lot of people are left wondering, who the hell are they anymore? And where do they stand in the world? And do they matter? And do they have any control anymore over their lives? And will they be able to, you know, raise their kids and have a good future for their kids? And that anxiety is here in the United States. And I think President Trump was, I think President Obama said this right in his remarks, President Trump is just an outcome of that anxiety, and we all need to address that anxiety in ways we clearly haven't successfully and deal with it. So my greatest concern is that anxiety will lead us to a nationalism and an isolationism that has never come out well for us, ever.
Ambassador Wendy Sherman was a former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in the Obama administration, and she was the lead negotiator for the Iran nuclear deal. She's also the author of Not for the Faint of Heart, Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persistence. It's published by Public Affairs. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.